Good morning to everyone. So, as you know, our topic is yoga in everyday life. So, we will have a discussion till 11 o'clock and then we will have question and answer session. Now, this yoga is a term that's now well known. Originally, the word means sublimation, joining, transcending. These are some of the meanings. The word comes from the Sanskrit root, like Latin, Sanskrit language has many roots, verbal roots, and also nominal roots. So here the root is yuj, which means putting together, transcending, going beyond. Now, to understand the implication of this word, we need some discussion on human personality. So, what are we? And what is life? What is the nature of human personality? If we look upon ourselves as human bodies, then we are all momentary objects which come and go. Sometimes we think of ourselves as thinking, feeling beings. There we go beyond the bodily dimension of the personality. We look upon ourselves as mind or intellects. Now Vedanta says we are in our true nature something that goes beyond body, mind, intellect, or any of these things. We are the all-pervading supreme reality, consciousness. This is a central principle. But we don't realize this because the mind is distracted towards different objects. So at the very beginning, I shall give a brief analysis of what mind is in yoga, human mind. Of course, this phenomenon of mind is analyzed from different angles in yoga. Sometimes it's called chittam, mind, mana, and so on. This mind has got five dimensions in Veda, yoga, depending upon the level of concentration, the evolution of a person, our mind to concentrate on things. The most common the most common place, the general condition of the mind is a state of being distracted. See, just look upon our own personality. When we look at something, our eyes and mind come together and we perceive an object. For example, this glass. I am able to see this glass because my eyes and mind come together. I am able to hear the noise from the road, a moving vehicle. My mind and my sense of hearing come together. I am able to feel the presence of this table, because when I touch this table with my finger, this sense of touch and mind come together. Like that. The five senses of perception and mind come together. So we perceive by hearing, feeling, thinking, touching, smelling, and so on. This means mind is constantly being dragged towards external objects. This is normal state. When you walk in the street, when you drive, your mind will be thinking about the traffic signs, or our mind may be thinking about certain things that we saw early in the morning. There we are trying to bring back to the mind the visual objects that we saw in the morning. Or when we are trying to remember some song we are trying to bring back to the mind, a memory, audio memory. So we re-experience, we relive those experiences. That means mind is distracted. This state of mind is called vimodha. In Sanskrit, it's called vimodha. It means a state of complete distraction. That mind is not able to concentrate. For one second, it is able to focus on one object. But next moment, it is distracted and it moves towards another object. Object need not necessarily be a visual object. Even when you think of something that you experienced 10 years back, you re-experience the visual object. That is also seeing mentally. Now, this is the most common thing. Always in a state of distraction and instability. And this is also sometimes analyzed from different angle. That is kshipta, means mind is always in a state of restlessness. Both are interrelated. So sometimes mind is distracted towards external objects. Sometimes without being distracted, it is in a state of inherent restlessness. This is very natural. And sometimes mind becomes dull. It loses its ability towards distracted, towards any objects, to get distracted. Sometimes when you are depressed, if somebody asks, well, there is a wonderful film, oh, I am not interested. That person normally will immediately join you maybe there is a football game going on the TV. Yeah, I am not interested. That person normally shows a lot of interest, but his mind is in a state of total dullness. This state is called mudha. These are the three states. Sanskrit names, you need not worry. After the class, some of them used to ask me the Sanskrit names because they want to read. If you read the complete works of Swami Vivekananda, if you read any book on yoga, you'll find these terms. So sometimes familiarity with these terms will help you to know what they mean in those books. There are many English books also that they use these terms. So state of total dullness and a state of different levels of restlessness and distraction. These are the most common states of human mind. Then there are certain people, see great scientists like Newton or Einstein. In those days there were no electronic gadgets, so they could not calculate with the help of calculators or computers. So they had to exercise their mind to the utmost. Modern electronic gadgets take away all this burden. So a lot of things they can do in a laboratory and put everything in a computer and after some days they can come back and continue the research. But in early days, great scientists had to retain many of these things in their minds, which needed a lot of concentration, single-pointed, focused concentration. Now, their minds are extremely one-pointed, focused and concentrated. This is a higher mind. Great mystics, great poets, great painters, great scientists, anybody who has done some great outstanding work which needed exercising the mind with great concentration and focus, always had their mind in a state of complete concentration. Single-minded, single-pointed concentration. This state of mind is sometimes you find a Sanskrit term, ekagra, means that term is very interesting. Agra in Sanskrit means edge. See, if you got a spear, the sharpest point is called agra, sharpest point of the spear. If you got a knife, a very sharp knife, the sharp edge is called agra. Now, if the If the edge is very blunt, very broad, it is not sharp. It is distracted. There, the edge is not one. It is so broad. So if you touch it, its touch spreads over a larger space. But if the spear is very sharp, one-pointed, if you touch it, it touches only one point. The Sanskrit term is ekagra, means one-pointedness, or a state of being single-pointed, focused, concentrated. That's the literal meaning. In fact, this is a higher state of mind. As I said earlier, no one can accomplish anything in philosophy, in poetry, in literature, in any art, music, or anything, except when their minds are highly concentrated. They should be always thinking about this one particular idea, worrying about one particular idea. In their mind, they'll be seeing those ideas in visual forms. They become identified with one idea. That is the case of Newton, Einstein, and the great scientists. They completely lost their own personality. Their personality got merged into that great, grand idea. It may be scientific discovery or whatever it may be. This is the fourth state of human mind. But here again, there is an element of yoga, but it is not necessarily spiritual, but it is certainly a highly evolved state of human mind. Because the mind has lifted itself off from the lower levels of distraction, a state of complete dissipation, being dissipated by different objects around us. The fifth stage is called Niruddha. Niruddha here means going beyond all kinds of modifications, distractions, conflicts, worries, where the mind takes to a higher region, when the mind transcends itself beyond and above all distractions and modifications. Now, the purpose of yoga is ultimately, eventually, to take us to this state of mind. We can experience complete restfulness, peace, harmony within, only when we reach this mind. This is the purpose of all kinds of spiritual practices, to reach this state. In that state, we enjoy perfect harmony and peace, complete freedom from conflicts and distractions within. No conflict, no disharmony. And at the same time, perfect harmony with the rest of the world. So, enjoying peace and harmony within and experiencing, practicing peace and harmony while interacting with other people. That's the way. You know, any expression of disharmony, restlessness, it takes external form, is an expression of disharmony and restlessness within. In psychiatry, it's you know, sometimes it's called, it is a drunkard's jokes, it is drunkard's jokes. So a drunkard who has no money, no home, nothing to enjoy, may be driven out of his home by his wife, or in the case of wife, by husband maybe by wife. The old example is given. He sits in a street corner and very, very happy, cuts jokes. He, all the time he's cutting jokes. In fact, if he stopped cutting jokes, he would go mad. He would become manic. So to avoid that pestering, the conflicts within, he is so humorous, so given to cutting jokes and enjoying. People would think he's a wonderful man, but actually, he cannot keep quiet for 1 minute. The moment, if he tries to keep quiet, his condition will be miserable. So he wants to run away from himself. It is an attempt to run away from the true condition. It's called but it's called complete. He wants to run away from the world of realities and wants to create an artificial world in which everything is very pleasant, very happy. So he cuts jokes, he becomes very humorous, very hilarious. These names have got new names in modern psychiatry, perhaps. Now, this shows that the absence or lack of inner harmony expresses itself in some kinds of abnormality, irritable temper. Sometimes it may take the opposite form. Instead of being irritated, the person tries to be humorous. So something out of the way. So these inner conflicts take different forms. Yoga's purpose is, on the one hand, to have an integrated personality, integrated mind, perfect harmony and peace within. At the same time, perfect harmony and peace with the rest of the world. It doesn't mean this. When we put this idea, people ask the question, and it's a very serious question. Suppose we practice yoga. We do a lot of meditation, so we enjoy peace and harmony within. But those whom we are living with, they are not practicing yoga necessarily. They may not be enjoying peace and harmony. So how do we react with them? If we are living in a world inhabited by yogis, everything is fine. But unfortunately, the whole planet is not inhabited by 7 billion yogis. We are always forced to live in a condition surrounded by people who are not necessarily yogis. So how to solve this problem? That's the main problem. Now, Patanjali says there is only one way. Look at this external world as something not absolute, I mean relative. The external conditions are not permanent. They are in a flux. We often worry about a problem when we think the problem is a serious problem, the problem is permanent, the problem can never be solved, the cause of the problem is eternal, everlasting. So people become miserable because of poverty, because they think poverty is an eternal condition. But if they think poverty is a changing phase of human life, then they won't be worried about poverty. They may solve the they may solve the problem of poverty, but they won't be worried about it. So yogis say, we look at the whole world as being in a state of flux, as something impermanent. That will help us to enjoy peace and harmony within, and also be in a state of peace and harmony with the rest of the world. Now, in Vedantic tradition, in yoga tradition, there are four yogas normally mentioned. These four yogas are, as many of you know, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga. Karma Yoga is the path towards this yoga experience, towards yoga, through the path of action, combining action and contemplation. Bhakti Yoga means the path of devotion. And Jnana Yoga means the path of philosophical, rational analysis of the reality of things around us. Raja Yoga, of course, it means concentrating the mind, training the mind to concentrate itself. But this aspect of concentration is associated with all the other three concepts of yoga. So it need not be dealt with independently. Now, as I said, human beings belong to different temperaments, different personalities. And our emotions, thinking, our idea of what we are, and our concept of the external world, all these are influenced by our actions, our behaviors. And for this, again, we have to go back to the mystery of human personality. As I said, human personality is a complex mechanism. People belong to different temperaments. Some of us are action-oriented. We are very active by nature. Some of us are emotional by nature. Some of us are intellectually evolved. We think, we intellectually try to analyze things. So different temperaments. These temperaments are influenced by certain undercurrents which constitute our inner personality. Inner personality behind the mind, behind intellect, behind the body. There are certain inherited, acquired tendencies, what we call vasanas, vrittis, samskaras, which influence the way we behave, the way we look upon others, the way we look upon people around us. So, as Vedantins believe, the core of our personality is sometimes called sukshma sharira, means the subtle personality. Subtle personality. If I just give an example, why do we behave the way we behave? Behavioral psychology or modern psychology can only analyze and study from an external point of view. They subject our behavior patterns scientifically and try to analyze, but they cannot give the answer to the question why. They can only answer the question how. How we behave, science can answer. Why should it be so? Modern science cannot do. Cannot make an attempt to answer this question. Now, Yoga and Vedanta believe that we are a complex personality because we have acquired, we have inherited, we have brought with us certain invisible, subtle personality characteristics which cannot be traced to any of our experiences in this life. Swami Vivekananda makes one statement in Rajyoga lectures. We are good because we can't help being good. We are bad, we can't help being bad. There are certain things that we do in a certain way, even if you try our best to behave, to do differently. So there are people who will take a strong determination. I shall always speak the truth. But when the moment comes, they don't know why. They may not be able to speak the truth. See, we can program a computer, a machine, but we can never program our own behavior. We can never predict it. That's why some of the greatest behavioral scientists who do a lot of counseling patients, who teach them you should adjustability, social adjustability, all these are essential criteria for intelligent, rational behavior. They are very good at giving counseling. They may have PhDs in behavioral psychology, but they themselves become eccentrics. You often find this. So the point is, we can control the machine, we can program the computer, but we can never program or control our own mind. Which means we have inherited certain characteristics, certain mysterious, untraceable behavior patterns, which we cannot explain in terms of our experiences in this life. No, yoga calls it inherited vasanas, tendencies, impressions that we have brought with us from previous life. In fact, that's one important point to remember. Yoga and Vedanta assert again and again one important principle. We do not have just one life. That's one important point. Life doesn't move in a straight line. Life moves in a cycle. Now, if you look up upon a cycle, we don't know where it begins. We don't know where it ends. So we are not what we are because of what we did in this life. We are what we are also because of what we did in some other lives before this birth. Which means we carry with us a huge bundle of inherited characteristics, behavior patterns, tendencies. We can't help it. Now, this bundle is called Sukshma Sharira in Vedanta. And this bundle is very, very big bundle. It contains all kinds of tendencies and impressions. Sometimes you feel, in fact, in this multiple personality and schizophrenia are sometimes analyzed in the light of inherited past karmas and vasanas and vrittis. Some of the conflicts cannot be explained otherwise. So, there are some tendencies which are good, some which are not so very good. Now, these tendencies are concentrated. They are stored in a bundle. It's called chitta. And these tendencies are acquired through actions. Actions performed in the mind and different senses of action in the last life or maybe in hundreds of life in the past. What we had done maybe 1,000 years back, maybe 20 lives before, may be influencing our thinking today. For example, when we walk in the streets, there is a temple, there may be a church where spiritual practices are going on. There may be also places where undesirable activities are going on. People may be walking in front of them. Now, suppose you have a choice. You can move in whichever direction you want. What determines our choice? Whether go to a temple or a church where we can meditate, we can think of higher things, or go in the opposite direction, being distracted in the opposite direction, what determines? The same family, 5 children, getting identical education, same parents, everything, but 5 different personalities, 5 different levels of thinking, distracted to 5 directions. Why does this happen? So, yoga says we have inherited certain tendencies and impressions which constitute our behavior, our personality. Generally speaking, there are different levels of analysis. The simplest analysis is classification of this personality into 17 elements. 17. Mind and intellect constitute 2. Then 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, and 5 elements. Or one sometimes you can say 5 levels of vrittis. Both were included. Which means 15 plus 2. Total 17. It's called Sukshma Sharira. Now one may ask this question, and often these questions are discussed. Suppose somebody tells you that this subtle inherited personality that we are carrying from previous life, if it includes 5 senses of perception and 5 senses of action, how do you explain this? Because your 5 senses of perception as we, as visible, will be destroyed with this body. 5 senses of action also, feet, hands, all these, or 5 senses of perception like eyes and ears, all these will go with this body. So, how do we explain this question? These 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, also constitute the subtle personality, which influences our behavior. The answer is this. What we have done, what we have seen with these eyes, will be registered in the mind as a subtle tendency or impression. These eyes will go with this body. When this body goes away, these eyes will go away. The ears also go away. But what you have seen with these eyes will create an impression that will be stored in this subtle personality. What you have heard will be stored in this subtle personality. So there is a residual tendency impression that remains intact even after the body perishes away. So what happens? These tendencies, these impressions will influence our behavior. And they will later on determine how we behave. So Vedanta says, Yoga says, that we can sublimate all these tendencies and impressions through controlling the mind, through meditation. Because these inherited tendencies and impressions, we belong to different levels of personality, distract the mind towards various objects, creating conflicts and distractions and worries. And this problem can be solved only by the practice of yoga, which means sublimating these tendencies to a higher spiritual level. This is the purpose of yoga. That's why people, even if you place people in the best of circumstances, if you go to a church or a temple where you are supposed to meditate on God, people can't do that. We do everything other than thinking spiritual things. A Ramana Maharshi could sit in a marketplace still think of God. A Sri Ramakrishna could stay in a place where, without any spiritual environment, and still think of God. But people who are highly influenced by negative tendencies and impressions, you place them right in the presence of Jesus, Buddha, all these people are coming there. You put them, they'll be thinking of something else. That's something very interesting. Now, yoga gives a solution to this problem. On the one hand, yoga teaches us to make use of the favorable circumstances. That's the purpose of yoga. Because of the powerful influence, the pull of inherited negative samskaras and vrittis, we are distracted in one direction. Now, how to fight this distraction and turn the mind towards positive channel? That is one important purpose of yoga. Another important purpose of yoga is to train the mind to acquire good impressions. Both are very important. Okay, now I think. So, basically, we have an hour more. Now, as I said earlier, these different parts in yoga are explained in the Bhagavad Gita and also in the Yoga Sutras. Bhagavad Gita expounds yoga as a total attitude, a total and complete approach to a spiritual life. Not only spiritual life, to secular life. Please remember, yoga is not meant only for spiritual seekers. That's one important purpose of yoga. In fact, karma yoga can be practiced from where you stand. Karma yoga can be practiced by a farmer in his ranch, or maybe a factory worker, or anybody. The subtle distinction between the secular and spiritual vanishes when we discuss yoga. In fact, that's one important purpose of yoga. Because often we try to divide our life into secular and spiritual. Spiritual, by spiritual we mean meditation. Meditation in the morning, reading sacred scriptures, thinking and higher, so-called higher things. Secular means everything else. Now yoga teaches us that we cannot divide life into different compartments. That is wrong, that is irrational, that is unscientific. Yoga says there is no distinction between secular and spiritual. Every act can be turned into yoga. Every word can be turned into yoga. Every moment can be utilized for practicing yoga. Yoga is not religion. Please remember, yoga is not religion. Yoga is a way of life. In fact, all the great spiritual religious teachers were yogis. But remember, yoga by itself is not religion as it is normally understood in the world today. Sometimes it is misunderstood that yoga is not religion. Yoga is a total approach. So in that respect, you can say Jesus was a yogi, Buddha was a yogi, just as Ramakrishna Paramahamsa was a yogi, or the great teacher of yoga, philosopher Patanjali, was a yogi. So anybody who tries to sublimate his level to a higher level, to a higher region, anybody who tries to think of getting freedom, freedom from conflicts, freedom from the tyranny of senses. As I said, senses drag the mind towards all directions. So any person who wants to get freedom from this tyranny can practice yoga. Yoga is the way to freedom, in short. Okay, now I will come to the second part of the subject. As I said, the beginning, one purpose of yoga is sublimate, to integrate these acquired, inherited tendencies which create conflicts and distractions within our mind. Because as I said, you know, even the best of things are offered, the mind turns away and mind moves in another direction. That's what happens. So how to keep the mind in tune with the spiritual undercurrents that the world has generated? In fact, you'd be surprised to know, Swami Vivekananda makes a very interesting statement in one of his lectures. That's maybe an introduction to Raj Yoga lectures. He says, if you enter a cave or an isolated place, maybe in the temple site here in Olima, sit there and think five noble thoughts and come back and go there again. After millions of years, somebody going to the same place, if that person has got the same spiritual wavelength, these thoughts will catch him. That is the implication of what Swamiji says. So if you enter a cave and think five thoughts, they will not be lost. The succeeding generations will be benefited if they enter the same cave. That's why the whole world is pervaded by the spiritual currents and thought currents created by innumerable Buddhas, or Jesus, or Ramakrishna, or Shankaracharyas, any of the great spiritual personalities. Some of them we know, some of them we do not know. So these spiritual thought currents are everywhere. The moment we turn our mind to the right frequency and wavelength, these thought currents will flow through our mind. The moment we fill our mind with negative vibrations and negative tendencies, then even if Buddha himself comes in front of you, you ask him, you get out. That's the idea behind. So yoga helps us to tune our mind into the correct wavelength and frequency. That's why great places become spiritual, filled with spiritual currents, when you think spiritual thoughts. And when you go to that place, you are also benefited, influenced by the prevailing spiritual current around that place. That's the idea behind. The second purpose, as I mentioned, that I should emphasize again, how to keep on enriching our mind, acquiring more and more positive, spiritually helpful tendencies and impressions in our day-to-day life. That's why yoga in everyday life. People have to be engaged in different activities, not always in spiritual practices, not meditation or reading holy books all the time. People had to, all of us had to work in factories, offices, and engage ourselves in different activities which are not necessarily spiritual, spiritually oriented. So even while being engaged in secular activities, how we can acquire positive, spiritually enriching tendencies and impressions. And this is very important because the balance of these tendencies determines the way we behave. So, to give an example, I can quote one Sanskrit verse because that puts the idea on focus. There's a statement in old Sanskrit. So, can I explain? Yad ahareva viraje tad ahareva pravarje brahmacharyadva grihadva vanadva yad ahareva viraje tad ahareva pravarje. This is a Sanskrit verse which is quoted in four important Upanishads: Paramahamsa Upanishad, Narada Parivrajaka Upanishad, Sannyasa Upanishad, and so on. Now the meaning is this. That is very important. The meaning is, whenever you feel, well, the world is enough, now I must start leading a spiritual life. Don't waste 1 minute. Don't wait for 1 second. Straight away you should take a decision. That's a literal meaning. You can do that when you are a young man, when you are a student, or when you are a middle-aged person, a householder, when you are looking after responsibilities, anything. Means you should give a spiritual turn to your life. That's the meaning we had to emphasize here. But the idea is, don't waste a minute. That day, that moment itself, you should take a decision to start a new chapter in your life. That means to give a new turn, spiritual turn, to the flow of our life. That's the meaning. Now, some philosophers have discussed, why is it that it is stressed that you should not waste 1 minute? You should take a decision immediately. The explanation gives a glimpse to the subtle nature of human personality. Some philosophers argue that, see, when we reach a particular moment in our life, we feel a great interest in spiritual matters, in higher ideas, holy spiritual ideas, elevating spiritual ideas. And there is an opportunity, we should not waste 1 minute. Because for several ages you have been working, acquiring different tendencies, impressions, and the bundle of human personality is full of these impressions and tendencies, what we call vasanas. Some of them are very good, some of them are certainly not good. That's why this conflict. Should I go to that temple or a church, or should I go somewhere else? The conflict arises because two camps are fighting with each other. In fact, this fight is sometimes given, this inner conflict is sometimes termed as the interference of the Satan or the devil in Christian theological literature. Vedanta calls it the inner conflict, the same dark night of the soul. Whether I should do the good thing, I should talk to say spiritual person, spiritual topics, or I should select the different person, I should go up his way. I should get distracted in one direction, or I should move in the spiritual path. So, in fact, this conflict, if you read the works of Saint Teresa of Avila, now the devil is presenting a temptation before me. I should be alert. So you find Inner Warfare, many of these books you find. There, this conflict is analyzed as an interference of the Satan or the devil. That's a Christian theological tradition. It is correct if from the Christian theological angle. But yogic angle is well, it's an inner conflict. Both are the same. Dark night of the soul. The night is dark. That is common in both the traditions. Now, so what we should do? Now, yoga says we must keep on enriching the mind with positive tendencies and impressions. Whatever we do will have its impact on the mind. There is no doubt about it. You can't do anything and be totally free from it. If you think noble thoughts, if you do noble deeds, your account will be enriched. That will be deposited in the bank account of your life. And if you do wrong things, that also will be deposited in the bank, in the other side. That's all. Of course, the latter account is called in the region of the devil or Satan. In theological literature, and yoga literature is called negative tendencies and impressions. So there is no way out. But for a highly evolved person, for a highly person who is highly spiritually evolved, he can do everything in this world without being influenced by their actions. That's karma yoga. I mean, in the Gita, it is expounded very elaborately. It is possible for highly evolved persons, for great spiritual personalities, to do their work and duties without being influenced by the results of their actions. Their actions will not leave any mark, any residue in the mind. But for common people, whatever we do, it will leave a residue, some influence, leave a mark in the mind, a good or bad. So the only practical way is to go on enriching the account, the deposit of good tendencies, good impressions, and good actions. So go on doing good things. So even when you are engaged in daily work, we can think of higher thoughts that will enrich the mind, that will enrich the deposit of good tendencies and good impressions. So whatever we are doing, if we can keep the mind in touch with some spiritual ideas, that action becomes yoga. That becomes yoga. So yoga is joining. Whatever we do, thinking is an action, speaking is an action, physical action. With all these, if we keep in our mind an idea of non-attachment, that every act is a worship, this idea should be associated with whatever we do. Then it becomes yoga. Then you know what happens? These actions will not leave any negative residue. They will create only a positive influence in the chitta. So gradually the mind will go on in expanding. It will sublimate itself. Good tendencies, good impressions will enrich the mind. And in direct proportion to the increase of good tendencies and impressions, negative tendencies will be decreased. So mind always will remain in a highly sublimated stage. In fact, this is one important contribution of yoga. This could be practiced by anybody. Not necessarily in a temple or a church or a meditation hall. In fact, yoga asks you to establish a link between what we are doing in the office or factory with what we are thinking in the meditation room. So yoga teaches us to extend meditation beyond the meditation room, because it completely removes the barrier between the secular and spiritual. That's a great statement In fact, it's a state, there is a statement in the commentary written by Vyasa on Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So, but there he says, you know, the pravritti, nivritti, that should be synthesized. That mean, meaning is, you connect the secular with the spiritual. So there is no more secular, everything is spiritual. Because the moment we try to divide secular from the spiritual, separate secular from the spiritual, there's always one problem. In fact, that is a serious problem which is discussed by Augustine in Confessions. He says, the real purpose of confession is not renewing the license for doing what we want to do. The real confession is eradication of all the evil tendencies of the past and starting a new spiritual life. So, yoga tries to spiritualize even the secular. That's the real purpose of yoga. Now we'll have discussion for about 35 minutes. This is the first day, so we'll devote more time, 35 minutes, for discussion. So you can take up any subject you want, and we'll have discussion.
So my question, since we talked about everyday life and especially about human personality, is one of the fundamental problems we have with people is to see where they come from. And you know, you delineated it in terms of vasanas and vrittis. It's really very hard to understand another person. And how do we actually relate to other people through the yogic methods? You know, not from an Atman perspective, but from through the mind. What would you say about that?
No, we need not try to study or analyze other people. That we need not do. This idea should be kept in mind, then we must focus on enriching our own tendencies and impressions. See, ultimately, the transformation takes place within us only, not outside. Transformation is unthinkable outside. Transformation takes place only within us. So we can only change our attitude and our approach. We cannot pursue others to change their attitude and their approach. So that's the idea. See, it says essentially subjective process, not objective.
How do we change that? I was talking about internal process, but you talked about it's very hard to see where the person is coming from.
But that we need not worry about where he's coming from or what he's where he's going. Our purpose should be because we should, yes. In fact, once we understand this idea in mind, then we'll be able to deal with equanimity, and we won't worry much about it. See, otherwise it becomes a dilemma. Once we understand this, it will not be a very big dilemma. We take in our stride because the world is, by its very nature, very diverse. It can't be otherwise. So that's why, you know, it's essentially a subjective process, sublimating our own tendencies and impressions by acquiring good tendencies through good actions, good thoughts, noble thoughts. I mean, diverting the five senses of perception and mind towards creative channels. Simple process. So you can think of these six factors: the senses, the sense of vision, eye, sense of hearing, the sense of smell, sense of touch, all these five senses of perception and mind. They should be diverted towards creative channels. At least we can avoid them getting distracted towards negative channels. That's one way. So some kind of conscious effort is necessary to keep trying to turn the mind towards positive, spiritually sublimating ideas. It could be by reading, it could be thinking, because we need not try to reform the world or try to study and analyze the workings of that's a great distraction. It's all right for the great spiritual teachers of the world, but for spiritual seekers, any attempt to analyze we can add to the distraction. As I did.
says there's good or bad, there's no such thing as bad. Coming to the same thing.
Yes, yes.
So there necessarily has to be some bad.
Yes, that's true.
So that becomes difficult sometimes, as you know. I know it should be our perception, that is the two sides of a coin. There's always going to be, whenever there's something good, there's always going to be some associated bad. I guess there's a balance of the universe which we don't see. So when we see the bad, we try to correct it, that's why. That's why the whole tendency of trying. So how do we see that the bad is also necessary? That it's necessary for that prostitute, it's necessary for that alcoholic to exist in this world, because for whatever, their karmas or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I have to learn to accept it.
In fact, this view which you stated just now, it would be all right for a Jesus or a Buddha, not for spiritual seekers. A spiritual seeker will have to use a strong sense of discrimination. Otherwise, the person is heading for a downfall. For a Buddha or a Jesus, for the highest spiritual personalities of the world, from the highest anchor, for Siddharmakrishna, Siddharmakrishna could transform Girichandra Ghosh, who was a drunkard, who was leading a loose life. But a Buddha could convert a robber into a saint, Angulimala story. So there was a robber, he heard the story. The robber was a notorious man, some of you may not have heard, right? So his job was, of course, he had a past which forced him to become a ruthless, reckless, cruel, bloodthirsty robber. And his hobby was to hunt down poor pilgrims. He will rob them, he will murder them, and after murdering, he will cut their fingers and he will make garlands of their fingers and he used to wear the garland. This was his big hobby. So Buddha was... one day Buddha was about to take a journey towards that pilgrim route. So some of his disciples just warned him, don't do that. Buddha didn't bother. But as Buddha, the story goes like that. And as Buddha walked, this man thought another 10 fingers he can get. And put your garland was getting rotten, you know. These fingers won't remain for long. So that's how he could manage to get his fresh garlands of human fingers. So when we tried to chase Buddha, Buddha didn't stop. Then he was struck with wonder. Normally, all these pilgrims used to run away for their life. But Buddha was not running away. But he could not catch up with Buddha. Buddha was walking slowly. Angulimala was running, but he could not catch up with Buddha. At one point, Buddha turned back. When Angulimala looked at his face, he fell at his feet. That is the beginning of a new life in his life. Now, an ordinary spiritual seeker should not attempt that. Girichandra Ghosh was a drunkard for obvious reasons. Girichandra Ghosh was a drunkard, a man who led a bohemian life. But when he met Sri Ramakrishna, he became a saint. Just imagine that transformation has got a great psychological implication for modern times. This man was most of the time he was unconscious, fully drunk. So Sri Ramakrishna told him, you try to take the name of God at least once or twice. The whole story I'm not giving you, stage by stage. But he's a very, very honest man, this man. He said, I don't know when I'm going to get up, so I can't be sure I'll be able to take the name of God when I get up. And I can't take a vow that I will take the name of God while die at the time of sleeping, because I don't know where I'm going to sleep or when. And he was very honest. Then Sri Ramakrishna told him, you give your power of attorney, I mean you give your spiritual responsibility to me. And he agreed. He did not know what it meant. But later he found it very difficult to drink. Because the moment he took a glass of this liquor, whatever it is, suddenly the face of Sri Ramakrishna flashed in his mind. Oh, I have given a promise to that old saint, so I should not do it again. But ordinary spiritual seekers can't do that. The problem is, ordinary spiritual seekers sometimes, we often have this problem. It is a serious problem. We often think, I'm also a spiritual seeker. I can also transform Girishandar Ghosh or Angulimala. We think that way. Or Jesus, like Jesus. The chances are that we will be transformed by them. There's a great hidden danger. Because, so if you, in psychiatry, it's called prophet syndrome. When we read some stories of great prophets, we try to imagine we also reached that stage. We have just read this life. So people will think that we are also coming from the great, some higher regions. We have some great mission to teach the world, to transform, to take wisdom, to teach people wisdom. This is designated as a great temptation of Satan in Christian theological literature. It's a great play of devil. It's a great trick played by devil in theological literature. And in the yogic tradition, it is a great temptation. It's something called Bhranti Darsanam in Ved Patanjali calls. Great inner deception mechanism. So we should be very careful. So sometimes we read big Vedanta philosophy. If sarvam khalu idam brahma, everything is Brahman, everything is consciousness. So I can go out, I can talk. There's a great danger. So we should slowly try to evolve. And before that, we should not try to play the roles of great saints and sages. So we need to worry about that. What we can do, we can focus on our own mind and go on trying to enrich our mind with good thoughts, good ideas, good noble deeds. Focus on that and we find suddenly mind evolves. So we should not try to rationalize or analyze like that. This is very, very, very important. In fact, Girishandra Ghosh episode is a great illustration. It has got many psychological implications. Just imagine. Sri Ramakrishna understood one important thing. This man is very sincere. He did not say, well, tomorrow onwards I shall not drink. He didn't say that. He was a very honest man. Many drunkards will say, tomorrow onwards I will not drink, and next day they will go. They will not become saints. They will not take seriously the instructions of any great spiritual teacher. And nothing will happen to them. But Sri Ramakrishna understood this man is very sincere. If he were not sincere, he would have said, tomorrow onwards I shall become a teetotaler. I won't do it. And that would be a trick, nasty trick he would be playing upon this great saint, Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna understood this man is sincere. He was not willing to give a promise to do something which he knew he will not be able to do. That's a great important point. So Sri Ramakrishna made use of that good tendency, that good samskara, that good characteristic of this man and made him a saint. So, of course, Angulimala's story is half mythical, but it is recorded in all histories of Buddha. But you can find such stories, such events in the lives of great saints, with Jesus Christ, Shankaracharya, only find such stories. But we should not try to transform. What we can do, we can focus on our own mind. And again, logical or theoretical analysis beyond the limit is a liability, as its problems. This is something that we must start practicing rather than logically analyzing. Logical analysis is also a great inner trap. Is a person sitting on one side of the river saying, well, what will happen if I jump into the river, water is cold, and then there is a dog, barking dog, maybe mad dog, rabid dog, that is tied to a post on the other side of the river, other bank of the river, by a chain. Suppose the whole river gets dried up, and if that dog breaks his chain and chases me, what will I do? See, an example is given in some of the scriptures. To what extent logic and rational analysis can take us in the wrong direction? So that's why in spiritual life, practical spiritual life, logical analysis beyond the mind, trying to logically analyze the whole world, is a big inner trap. So that's why your Patanjali says this much. The ultimate purpose is yoga chitta vritti nirodha, reaching the niruddha state where mind is completely in a state of purity, totally sublimated. That's a goal, but it's a long, distant goal. Before reaching that goal, we must be careful about what steps we are taking. So slowly go on enriching the mind with good thoughts, good ideas, noble thoughts, noble ideas, noble deeds. That's what Patanjali says. That's the idea.
Follow-up question for that. So at what point can we know that we have crossed beyond the point where we are just thinking and doing good deeds to the point where we start giving up the fruits, or we have moved on to the next level? How do we know that?
In fact, once we, the speciality of yoga is, once we start practicing some of these things, mind itself become a good guide. Mind itself will turn us. I mean, take us in the correct direction. So that's why the first thing we can do, along with whatever we are doing, official work or professional duties and responsibility, along with that, reading these ideas, listening to these ideas, and then practicing prayer, all these will help us to keep the mind in a higher level, at a higher level, in a state of spiritual vibrations. That's the idea behind. That will neutralize the impact of negative tendencies that we may have acquired sometime in the past. We do not know. Because how we behave, how these inherited tendencies act in our present life can be seen only when we are in touch with good or bad situations. That's why, there is a context in the Gita. Arjuna asks some of these questions. Two questions Arjuna asks. One important question is this. See, even when we don't want to do anything bad, if we don't want to do anything bad, we want to do good things, we want to avoid doing and undesirable things, and we want to keep doing good, desirable things, still, mind, as it were, gets distracted towards negative things. Why does this happen? How does this happen? That is the question where Arjuna asked Krishna. Second question where Arjuna asked, that is in 6th chapter. The second question is this. Suppose a person tries to practice yoga, practicing meditation, enriching mind with good tendencies. Suppose that he doesn't succeed. It could happen that he may be distracted, he may be deviated, or he may die before he reaches the spiritual goal. It happens. It's a very common question. Suppose you teach somebody, well, you should practice meditation, the realization of the ultimate goal. But that person asks the question, well, suppose I don't succeed. I meditate for some time, and still I have a tendency towards undesirable thoughts, undesirable conversations, undesirable activities, undesirable attitudes. I don't want that. Still, my mind, as if it is propelled by some inner force, gets distracted. And then if the person faces a downfall, what will happen? All the efforts, all the meditation you have done, all the prayers, all the reading, all the retreats, winter retreats that you attended, all will go in vain. It's a natural question. Sri Krishna gives a very logical answer. Nothing will be lost. Sri Krishna's answer is this. Suppose in your whole life you have meditated only for half an hour in your day. You have read, see, the Bible or the Upanishads or any of the great holy scriptures only once in your life. You have listened only once to some good lectures. that will not be lost. That will be saved in your bank account. That's the idea behind. So, nothing will be lost. This sloka, the sixth chapter, this long discussion about this. Krishna says that whatever little spiritual practice you have done in this life, you will enjoy its fruits. That's why sometimes when we go to a library, you may find many magazines on the table. You may find many books on the racks, shelves. Sometimes unconsciously we feel we are attracted to a certain good books. Or we sit in your room, you have got all kinds of books and magazines. You feel attracted to a certain good books. Why this has happened? Because sometime in the past, you have read it. It may not be last century, maybe in the 8th century or 5th century AD, you have read it. Sometime in some other life. Not necessarily Upanishad. You may have read the Bible, you may have read or the Torah, whatever it is. Any religious book. Any book that gives you some high spiritual ideal. Or you may have prayed only once. That will become a great guiding force in 21st century. So you feel the same attraction towards similar ideas, similar concepts. That's what happens. On the other hand, sometimes negative tendencies also can work in this way. They also can drag us away in that direction. That's why it is important to keep enriching the mind with good, noble and sublime thought currents. And whenever unhealthy or negative thought currents try to creep into the mind, try to use a filter mechanism. So that's a term used by Swami Yatheswarandaji in meditation spiritual practice. He was lecturing all over Europe. He worked in America also. Swami Yatheswarandaji, very senior monk of Ramakrishna order. So addressing some spiritual seekers in Europe, he uses the term filtering mechanism. So whenever negative tendencies, negative ideas come from people, use in your mind a filtering mechanism so that they will not create a deep impact on the mind. Otherwise, this influence can pull the mind in the wrong direction, can bring it down. Or you can, to neutralize it, you can go and read a Bible or Gita or whatever it is. That's also possible. So the point is this, nothing will be lost. The slightest spiritual practice done sincerely, even once in life, will not be lost. Because Vedanta and Yoga believe in, not in one life, but in continued existence. You know. Till you get the absolute spiritual liberation, you keep taking births. That's the idea behind. So existence at the individual level and existence at the cosmic level are looked upon as cyclic processes in Vedanta. That's the idea.
Swami, can you give us some specifics on how to tune our minds to spiritual influences and thoughts?
As I said, it's only general things, but reading the Gita or the Bible or any religious books every day, and trying to remember those ideas even when you are engaged in so-called secular activities. Ultimate goal is to burn the bridge between the secular and spiritual, make them one. Spiritualization of the totality of human life is the goal. To begin with, reading every day. And try to, this is very important, establish a link between the ideas that you acquire while reading and at other times when you are not reading. Because, that is very important. Application comes later, but even while not being engaged in spiritual practices, we can think of some spiritual thoughts that will gradually percolate, spread spiritual ideas all over, throughout our 24 hours life.
This continuation of life. life, just desires and the vasanas.
Yeah.
Sometimes, so you know, when we try not to have desires, but it just unconsciously, I go to say a shop to buy a sari, then I see three other saris, and mentally I say, oh, I wish I had those saris. So that becomes again a desire that accumulates in my bank account for my future life.
And in fact, I tell you, no,
so
of course,
many other desires.
That's true. These desires will accumulate, but they are not permanent. In fact, the permanent tendencies are related to our conscious activities. Then, suppose you have bought this cloth, and you become very proud of having bought this cloth, and you make too much of it and show it to your friends, then it can become. Otherwise, you need something, you want to buy, it may not leave a permanent mark. But being obsessed with the ownership of that cloth that you bought, and being very proud to show it off, wear it all the time, and you will be proud of it, that can create. We buy food, we buy clothing, that doesn't leave a permanent mark. When we identify ourselves with that object, with the enjoyership of that act of buying, it is the enjoyership, it's called bhoktrutvam in Sanskrit. So I am the one who has bought it, I should enjoy it. This strong identification leaves a permanent mark. I can give a little illustration of how this really happens in practical life. Suppose you are walking along the road. You will find so many dry leaves, stones and pebbles spread all over the street. You don't remember those things. You have seen them. You may have even removed a stone just lying in the middle of the road to make way for your car. But you don't remember. But suppose you have lost something very precious. God forbid it ever happens. Suppose you have lost your passport or identity card. You know you may have dropped it somewhere along this track here. And you go in search of it. Suddenly you find it lying in the middle of the street. You don't fail to recognize it. Why? Because your whole mind was thinking of that lost object. So when you find it lying on the street, you will never make a mistake. Immediately you grab it. Why? Because your mind was always thinking about that. So if the mind constantly dwells, thinks of that particular object, it leaves a mark. Otherwise not. This is a classic example. So that's why great spiritual seekers who enrich the mind with spiritual thoughts, they can quickly understand the implication when you read the scripture. Because mind is ready. It's not that that person is more intelligent or not. Mind is focused on that idea. So he quickly grasps it when he reads it, when he reads that book. On the other hand, if mind is distracted in so many directions, it will not grasp the implication of those spiritual ideas. So we have just five more minutes. If you have more questions, we'll ask.
In the process of answering other questions, you mentioned two things. One was the filtering mechanism to push away the negative things.
Yeah.
And to Kathy, you said about trying to remember, let's say, the ideas from the Gita at other times when you're not reading it. Now, to recollect this, or to be at the moment when it's needed to implement it, a great level of awareness is needed. You have to really live consciously to approach it in the right way. How to keep your awareness level high throughout the day? Because we succumb to emotions, we succumb to the other guy, we succumb to our own samskaras coming up. And you feel helpless most of the time. So how do you keep your awareness level up?
No, constant effort. Conscious effort is only one method.
Mm-hmm.
constant effort will guarantee success consciously. It won't happen in a day, in a few days, but constant effort to get mind in, to keep the mind in the world of spiritual ideas, even when you are not reading it. This effort will gradually increase the times when you are living in the world of spiritual ideas and decrease the times when you are away from it, proportionately. Proportionally, you find more and more you think of the higher ideas and less you think of other ideas. That's the idea.
So one of the issues in spiritual life is doubting mind. So can you talk about, you know, the reason for that and some of the filtering mechanisms that we can apply to get rid of that problem?
No, doubts with regard to normal human life situations.
I'm asking more of whether it is secular or spiritual life.
Mm.
Sometimes you see that samskara you talked about, that the mind is, you know, it doesn't usually trust.
Mm.
It doubts. Like, you know, if you lock the door, you know, just I'm giving a trivial example.
That is a psychiatric problem.
But yeah.
That is again the conflict. You go on checking whether you are locked the door or not, washing the hands.
But I'm extending
of course.
To
no, you are right. No, that is true. This kind of thing can happen to begin with. Of course, one method is to read the lives of great saints and sages, not teachings only. Because in spiritual life, to understand the implications of yoga, reading the lives of great spiritual personalities sometimes as helpful, sometimes even more helpful than reading their teachings. It depends upon the tendencies. But reading the life gives us the conviction that people do succeed in spiritual life. Great spiritual people lived in this world, still live in the world. That will reduce the doubts. See, this problem is real if we confine ourselves to studying the teachings only. But reading the life, real lives of great saints, gives us the conviction that spiritual life is not a utopian idea. It is really possible. That is the one. That's a very, very one important method. This is the that will reduce the doubts, because theoretically we can never prove the existence of God. It's impossible. In modern philosophy, in Aristotelian philosophy, see, perception, inference, all these two important epistemological tools cannot take us far. If you go to Christian theology, direct perception, inference, and then verbal testimony, that also. In Hindu philosophy, in some system, the 10 epistemological tools are accepted. Pratyaksha, Anumana, Upamana, and so on. None of these epistemological tools, theory of knowledge, can give us the conviction that God is real. Spirituality is possible. Spirituality, the idea that spirituality is real, that God is real, becomes more deep-rooted when we read the lives of great saints and sages, not while reading philosophy. In fact, great philosophers like Shankaracharya himself had stated this. The third important thing, Mahapurusha Samsaya. Vanishuttam, Umukshuttam, Mahapurusha Samsaya. Being born as a discriminating person with wisdom, then strong desire for spiritual enlightenment, liberation, and much more important, being in contact with great spiritual personalities. Now, how do we keep ourselves in contact with great spiritual personalities? You cannot go and meet Jesus Christ or Buddha today, or Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna Paramahansa. But if you read their life, you are coming in contact with their real personality. So, the third and most important condition for spiritual life, coming in contact with great spiritual personalities is possible by reading their life, much more than reading philosophy. This is accepted in all traditions. If you read the great book like Philokalia, only point is sometimes, you know, there is an element of, there is a mythification in many of these books that we have to leave out. But it's a great, great psychological element involved, which they share with all of us. It's common to all humanity. The psychological, spiritual element is common. The mythological element may not be shared by all. Often it may be confined with cultural, geographical barriers. But the spiritual and psychological element in all great spiritual literature is common, the whole common spiritual legacy of mankind. So there you find always the insistence on keeping in contact, keeping in touch with great spiritual personalities by reading their life, which is very, very helpful. Because that gives the conviction that God is real, not otherwise. So we'll conclude. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tatsat. So we will have the next session at 3:30.